Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Albert Slomovitz, PhD captain in the U.S. Navy Chaplain Corps, discussing Jews in the U.S. military chaplaincy and the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our young Shinshiniot, Ron Benicote and Rotem Rappaport. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. My friends, I promised to tell you this week about bringing our new congregation Beit Simcha's Torah back from London, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to postpone that one more week on Two Jewish, as amazing as the experience was. Suffice it to say that not only is it a really beautiful scroll, but the process of getting it home was extraordinary and meaningful. I'll share it all with you, but next Sunday. Today I need to stand on a proverbial soapbox for a few moments. We have been told very loudly and repeatedly that Israel's nation-state law, passed over the summer by the Israeli Knesset, is racist legislation that creates a system of apartheid for Israeli Arabs and destroys any hope for peace in the Middle East. Many Jews in America and Europe have sharply attacked the Israeli government for the nation-state law. Harsh criticism has been leveled at the Prime Minister, claiming that this law is the worst thing any nation has ever done to its own minority populations. How could a democracy pass such a racist law, we are asked? But if you read the actual statutes passed by Israel in the nation-state law, you will wonder just what the heck people are talking about. It includes such radical statements as, "The name of the state is Israel," and "Hatikva" is the national anthem, and the state flag is white with two blue stripes and a blue Star of David in the center. The state's language is Hebrew, it says, but makes special provisions and protections for Arabic speakers. This nation-state law affirms that the land of Israel is the historic homeland of the Jewish people and the national home of the Jewish people, and that the right to exercise national self-determination in the state of Israel is unique to the Jewish people. These were the ideals behind the settlement and foundation of Israel from its very beginning all the way back in 1948, and they have been central to it for more than 70 years. There is nothing new about anything in the nation-state law. The full text is available online for anybody who wishes to actually read it instead of just criticizing it. You should read it, because there isn't a country in the world that would be criticized for passing a similar set of such basic foundational laws confirming what it already is. It would be like America passing a law that said the United States of America is our national name and the Star-Spangled Banner is our... forgive us, national anthem, and the stars and stripes is our flag, and so on. Look, no other country would get this criticism. Only Israel gets heat for passing this kind of law. We know that Israel isn't perfect because no nation or state is. But before jumping to the ridiculous negative conclusions that Israel is bigoted and racist that the critics of Israel urge you to assume, please understand the facts in this situation. Read the actual text of the nation-state law. I believe you will come to a very different understanding about the quality and simple practicality of the only Jewish country in the entire world. You know, this world can be a little crazy. And so to play us in this morning on the theme of Israel, here's an Israeli hit from Omer Adam called Shnei Meshugaim. Two crazy people.
בואי נרוץ רחוק, תני לי רק כמה דקות להיזכר במקומות שאז היינו ילדים. לא פחדנו סתם לחיות בלי המינוס הצרות, בלי לתלות את התקוות, כמו כביסה על חבלים, כמו איזה שני משוגעים בחוף. שמרנו רגעים בלב, שתינו את הנוף, ואת היית יפה כמו פרח שאסור היה לקטוף. רציתי רק לקטוף אותך, רציתי לקטוף כמו איזה שני משוגעים בחוף. שמרנו רגעים בלב, שתינו את הנוף, ואת היית יפה כמו פרח שאסור היה לקטוף. רציתי רק לקטוף אותך, רציתי לקטוף כמו איזה שני משוגעים. בואי נרוץ רחוק ברגליים יחפות, מזיכרונות ואכזבות שאז רצינו לשחרר. כמעט ויתרנו על עצמנו, נברח רחוק מהשגרה כמו אז שהסתפקנו באושר הפשוט, כמו איזה שני משוגעים בחוף. שמרנו רגעים בלב, שתינו את הנוף, ואת היית יפה כמו פרח שאסור היה לקטוף. רציתי רק לקטוף אותך, רציתי לקטוף כמו איזה שני משוגעים בחוף. שמרנו רגעים בלב, שתינו את הנוף, ואת היית יפה כמו פרח שאסור היה לקטוף. רציתי רק לקטוף אותך, רציתי לקטוף כמו איזה שני משוגעים. רק לקטוף אותך, רציתי לקטוף כמו איזה שני משוגעים.
That was Omer Adam singing Shnei Meshugaim about how it used to be when we were just two crazy people in love on the beach. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Albert Slomovitz, Ph.D., full captain in the U.S. Navy Chaplain Corps, that's the equivalent of a full colonel in the Army, talking about Jewish chaplains in the U.S. military and the history of the U.S. Supreme Court, both of which he has written books about. Find out from a true expert what he thinks about both institutions when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi and Ph.D., Albi Slomovitz, is a longtime chaplain. I should address you as captain, right? Naval captain.
If you'd like.
Yes, sir. he has spent a career in the military, but has also written books on both Jewish fighting men and on the American Supreme Court, and is active in so many ways, teaches an extraordinary, and I think you'll find a wonderful guest. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish, Albi.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on the program.
So because the Supreme Court, we're going to kind of start backwards, because the Supreme Court is still on everybody's mind right now, having seen, you know, as an expert on the Supreme Court, having written America's Other Klan, your book about the U.S. Supreme Court, what did you think about this process, the confirmation hearings, all of that?
Well, let me just go back a step and tell you what I think, that people have this notion of the Supreme Court is almost nine angels that kind of float into their seats in the morning and they float back at night, and they're just spending most of their lives filled with reading legal documents and things like that. And when I wrote my book, I realized that they were people too. And sometimes people carry with them their prejudices. And the premise of my book was that the Supreme Court was just as complicit in the racism of the country, even though there were laws on the books that they actually could have used against racism. So I'll give you a quick example, and I'm answering you in a very roundabout way, if that's all right.
That's very Jewish, too, and it's a little bit like the way the Supreme Court judgments come about, too, I might add.
Right. There was a case, 1896, called Plessy v. Ferguson, which is well known.
Of course.
Which
even I know of that case.
There you go. Ushering in separate but equal. So and part of the decisions of the court, one of the things they said was, and I have my students memorize this little quote here, legislation is powerless to eradicate social instincts. And basically what the high court is saying is that the law, as we have it, can't eliminate these racial differences between people. And then they go on to say, if you try and force people together, it's going to be disastrous. So I guess my answer to the question is that in studying the Supreme Court, you realize that they're people and they're fallible and they have good points and bad points. So that's kind of what I discovered about the court. I have the utmost respect for them, but I think sometimes we don't appreciate how much their total lives are significant to making the judgments they make. So clearly the justices from the North and the South, by the way, people ask me geographical questions where they were from, but clearly the justices carry baggage, I guess, like everyone else. And I think we were seeing last week sort of an example of that.
We will have much, much more with Captain Rabbi Professor Avi Slomovitz when we come back on To Jewish, exploring Jews and Jewish military chaplains in American history and many other subjects. Congregation Beit Simcha, a new Jewish synagogue based in Northwest Tucson, celebrating its first services, classes, and events this fall. Established by a group of passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is dedicated to creating a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. As a new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson, Beit Simcha is open to all throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming in Northwest Tucson. Shabbat services will be at the Jewish Federation Building on River Road Friday night, November 2nd. That's the Evencheck Philanthropy Center. And will move to the Oro Valley Community Center November 9th for Friday night Shabbat services from then on. Saturday morning services begin November 3rd at the Educational Center, where a religious school and adult education academy courses are also offered on Oracle Road, north of Ina. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha and to come to services and adult education academy courses or religious school, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, www.BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me in the newest Jewish community in Southern Arizona at its very beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, streaming us from there, twojewishradio.com, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, talking to us from Israel, where he is leading a trip. Boker Tov, Amir. For you, of course, it's evening. Erev Tov, almost Laila Tov.
Yeah, Erev Tov, Rabbi.
So
good to hear from you.
Whenever I go to a place where I've lived before or spent a lot of time, I don't notice the things people that are going for the first time notice, which is, you know, the beach in Tel Aviv, the beauty of the sunrise, the Golan, the Galil, the Kotel. I notice the things that are different. What do you see that feels different going back to Israel this time?
So there are a couple of things. The first thing that I can say that, you know, jump is the highways. I can share with you that, you know, my years in the United States, my first years when people asked me, so how long it takes you from like Elat all the way to the north, you know, from south to north? So you would say 9 hours or you would say 8 hours. The right answer now is 5 hours and something. And the difference is the highways. You know, you have major highways that were developed that shortened the time to travel from north to south, toll roads will have, you know, restrooms and restaurants and places that you can stop and relax and rest before you go on. So highways definitely is something that that made a big difference in Israel, both to those who live here and those who come and visit. And then the second thing I would say, it's a funny thing, is customer service. You know, I remember being younger and visiting Israel or living in Israel, and the Israeli culture, you know, generally speaking, some people say we're rude, some people say that we're direct, but customer service was a challenge. And these days, I think because many Israelis traveled, and especially to the United States, and learned and improved, you know, customer service. Today, a customer calls and is listened to, and the problem is solved In a speedy way. So that's the two things that I can share with you.
Yeah, I mean, customer service used to be an oxymoron in Israel. Like, it didn't really ever
absolutely
happen. But it was like the old joke about, you know, like an El Al, the flight attendants, they would say, you know, what do you want for dinner? And you'd say, what are my choices? And their answer was yes or no. You know, it's not like that anymore.
Right.
It's a much more civilized place.
No. And we flown on El Al, so we flew El Al, and we were very impressed. I mean, really, I mean, I would give from 0 to 10 and 9 just to leave 1 to grow, but it was very, very good. I mean, really an excellent customer service. Felt at home and respected and served, and it was really a great experience.
Fantastic. This is all great stuff, and we will talk next week and hear more about the trip.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much, Amir. Nesia tova.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And as usual, you've just returned from a trip.
Right, a rather long trip. This trip ended with sort of R&R in Israel, just visiting friends in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. But it began with a very interesting group, about one quarter Tusonin, and about three quarters Jewish, who met together in Berlin. Most people on the trip spent Yom Kippur in Berlin and broke the fast together. And then the next day, toured around Berlin, and I think like Friday night after Yom Kippur, we had a welcome dinner and introductory session and briefing on our whole trip. And then we flew off the next morning to Riga, the capital of Latvia. We visited Riga, Vilnius, and Lviv in that order on our way to Vienna, which was the final stop. And, you know, Vienna and Berlin both are palpably more Western than the other places.
Yes, indeed.
And it was extremely interesting that as we went south among these three big cities, which all in their own ways were major centers of Jewish history, the standard of living got lower and lower. People were poorer. The cars were visibly less luxurious. Buildings needed a paint job. Prices were much lower. That was quite interesting and quite dramatic because they're not far away from each other. And each of these places in a way is sui generis. You know, the three Baltic countries speak languages that form their own family Well, actually, even that's not true, because Estonia speaks Estonian, which is a dialect of Finnish. It's like,
right,
you know, Southern Finnish. Latvia and Lithuania both speak Baltic languages, but they're not mutually comprehensible and they're unrelated to any other language. Younger people, if they speak Russian at all, they speak it with resentment. Older people grew up in Russian, so they're still comfortable speaking Russian, and it allows you to build bridges, especially if somebody's really, like, let's say over 65, there's almost no chance they're going to know English, but it's almost certain that they're going to know Russian, so you can have a conversation. Anyway, we went to Riga. We saw the Occupation Museum, which tells the history of three different occupations of Latvia. The occupation by the Russians, the occupation by the Soviets, and the occupation by the Nazis. And these were all terrible periods in Latvian history where Latvian culture, language, religion, blah, 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 were almost extinguished. And the museum devotes about a third of its space and resources to what happened to the Jews during the Nazi period. So, I mean, in a way, you don't have to look for anything else that's specifically Jewish because this museum does such a good job. The other thing that your listeners might find interesting is that Riga has more Art Nouveau buildings than any other city in the world. It has hundreds, and it has a museum of Art Nouveau and a whole district of Art Nouveau houses. And the vast majority of these buildings were designed by two architects, both of whom were Jewish, around the turn of the last century. So they're like these living monuments to Jewish creativity and the flourishing Jewish community that had once been there but is no longer.
Thank you, Tom. Well, that covers Latvia. We'll travel the rest of the route with you next week. Thanks so much.
Looking forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Benny's dog dies. He goes to see the Chabad rabbi. "Rabbi, I wonder whether you could find time to say a special blessing at my dog's grave." The rabbi replies, "I'm sorry. I'm afraid it's not possible, Benny. In Jewish law and halacha, the rules don't make any allowance for animals." Benny says, "But I'm really upset, Rabbi." "Well, maybe you should go see the Reform rabbi across the street," says the Chabad rabbi. Benny starts to walk away dejectedly. Then he turns back to the rabbi and says, "Such a shame. I was willing to donate $20,000 for such a funeral." At which point the Chabad rabbi shouts, "Come back, come back." Then he turns around and says, "I thought you couldn't help me." "Ah," says the rabbi, "you didn't tell me your dog was Orthodox." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, Ron Benekoth, and Rotem Rapoport, representing the younger perspective on Israel, our representative in Israel for the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
And I should say almost happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Now, that's not a holiday you guys are familiar with from before.
Yes. We don't have Halloween in Israel, but it's really fun to see everything here in the spirit of Halloween and scary and decorated from a lot of time before that. So it's pretty cool.
And you do have a holiday, though, in which people dress up, right?
Yes, we have Purim, which is in March or April, it depends. And it's people dress up in costumes and related.
Kind of everybody does. It's not just little kids. Like, yeah. Everybody dresses for Purim in Israel.
Yeah, we have Purim parties for all ages. And it's related to the Torah, of course, and we also have this decorations Purim style, but it's different.
So what's the difference, really, if you had to put your finger on it?
I feel like the food is different. Like, everything here is all pumpkin and all different kind of spices that we don't really use at Purim. You know, we have Osnaman.
Right, right. Hamantash, we call them in Yiddish. Okay. But right, the Haman's ears, which is the worst name for a pastry ever.
Yeah. And here it's more scary than in Israel. we feel like, I feel like in Israel it's more happy and princesses, and when you go out here you get to see all those scary costumes already for sale.
The skeletons, yeah, and the Draculas, the vampires,
it's
the
pretty
Frankensteins.
Scary. It's pretty scary.
Mike Myers, you know, all these delightful figures. So in experiencing this sort of first fall here in America, you know, you have fall festivals in Israel, but the earlier was Sukkot. Here it's kind of a different flavor. Do you miss being in Israel for it, or is this just kind of an additional special thing?
I think it's an additional to this special thing, just because we get to see more of the culture here. And we get to...
If you can call Halloween culture.
It's a culture. Come okay, on. It's a culture. And we get to see the differences between here and Israel. And it's really interesting because it's something that we never experienced before.
So, you know, Valentine's Day has migrated to Israel. And now on February 14th, you see everybody out on dates and there's balloons. Not as crazy as here, but kind of.
Yeah.
Do you think Halloween will ever migrate to Israel in the same way?
Wow, I hope so. It's really cool.
I don't think so, because it's really related to like Christians, I think, when like people in Israel see that. So they'll think of it like a holiday, like Christmas and stuff. So I don't know if that migrate, maybe in a special other way.
Maybe. Isn't it all about the candies right now?
Yeah, it's pretty much about candy. For
candies. Israelis love candies. Yeah, come on.
Yeah, and look, any excuse to have a party. All right. Thanks so much, guys. We'll talk next week.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
And now a word of Torah. Negotiation gets a bad rap these days. Many people see the give and take necessary to reach consensus as a kind of moral compromise, a sacrifice of ideals on the false idol altar of base pragmatism. Compromise, consensus, agreement, not words we hear much in an election year. But real progress in this world is usually a result of masa-umatan, the horse trading and log rolling that allows society to solve problems and attain new and important accomplishments. Where difference of opinion exists, and it always does, reasonable negotiation eventually leads to productive resolution. The Torah teaches that lesson in this week's portion of Chaye Sarah. Chaye Sarah marks a transition in the Genesis narrative from the tales of Abraham and Sarah, our first Jewish father and mother, towards a new generation which will feature Isaac and Rebekah. But first, we begin with an ending. At the start of the portion, we're told of the length of Sarah's life, and almost by accident, we learn that she has died. The life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, our portion begins, and the famous Midrash on it tells us Sarah was just as beautiful at age 100 as she was at 20, just as free of sin at 20 as she had been at 7. A fine encomium for a significant figure who now passes permanently from the scene. Next come the negotiations, which have great influence on the future of the fledgling religion someday to be known as Judaism. An extended section dedicated to arranging for Sarah's funeral, as Abraham arranges the purchase of the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron, the first piece of real estate owned by our people in what will be known as the Land of Israel. That cave, the Cave of Machpelah, becomes the burial place not only for Sarah, but for most of the patriarchs and matriarchs. Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, and Leah all eventually find their final resting place in this cave in the Hebron area. In Chaye Sarah, the purchase of the plot involves an elaborate bargaining session with the Hittite who owns it, and the payment of a huge sum for the first permanently Jewish land in the world, establishing Jewish legitimacy in the Middle East at a very early point in history. You know, I first visited the Cave of Machpelah many years ago when it was safer to travel to Hebron. It's an interesting shrine. At that time, you could go into the basement level where all of the caves are. It was filled with candles and smoke. Ancient, a little spooky. Most of the time these days, it's not really safe to go to Hebron, a place of frequent Palestinian violence against Jews. In our Torah portion, after the Cave of Machpelah negotiation, it goes on to include one last detailed episode of Abraham's life. Abraham is old, sees that his son Isaac has not yet married, and seems unlikely to do so without parental intervention. Abraham charges his trusted servant to go back to the old country of Sumeria, Haran, today in eastern Turkey, and bring back a suitable girl for Isaac to marry and carry on the line of believers in the one true God. The servant goes on a great journey from Canaan. He arrives, offers the first extended prayer in the Torah, asking the God of Abraham for success on this delicate mission. Immediately, Rebekah appears to draw water from the city well in Haran. He knows that she is the one for Isaac because she shows instinctive generosity and obvious intelligence. The servant, too, bargains, in this case with Rebekah's duplicitous brother and father. Eventually, they all arrange for Rebekah to become Isaac's wife. But at the crucial moment of the narrative, her family puts the question directly to her. Rebekah, will you go with this man? That is, will she leave all she has known and journey to an unknown land and future husband? The final negotiation of Chaye Sarah is brief. Rebekah agrees quickly to go. Yes, she will leave the homeland and her father's house and go to the land that will be shown to her. And so she goes and meets Isaac, and the future of the people and of monotheism is thus assured. These three negotiations revolve around crucial elements in our people's history: land, descendants, and destiny. Without title to the land of Israel, we would have remained homeless wanderers. Without descendants, we would have simply ceased to be. And without the courageous choice of women and men, like Rivka, like Rebekah, like Avraham, Abraham before her, our destiny would have been disappearance. As Jews, these remain our principal goals today, and often they still require negotiation to achieve: a secure land of Israel, our children and grandchildren's commitment to Judaism, and the destiny of our people as a moral light to the nations. Aren't those causes worth negotiating for? When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Albi Slomovitz, a full captain in the Navy, PhD, and author of an excellent book on Jews and chaplains in the U.S. military, will try to explain why American Jews celebrate the feats of the Israeli army but don't do the same so much for Jews in the American armed services. Hear from him when we return in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Disturbing and fascinating case in the news this week relating to foster parenting and adoption from a place I used to live in, upstate South Carolina. The Trump administration is currently considering whether to grant a South Carolina request that would allow faith-based foster care agencies the ability to deny Jewish parents from fostering children in its network. The argument from the state and the agency is that the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act should not force a Protestant group to work with Jewish people if it violates a tenet of their faith. If granted, this exemption would allow Miracle Hill Ministries, a Protestant social service agency working in the state's northwest region, to continue receiving federal dollars while recruiting only Christian foster families. That discrimination would apply not just to Jewish parents, but also to parents who are Muslim, Catholic, Unitarian, atheist, agnostic, or some other non-Protestant Christian denomination. Miracle Hill covers Greenville, Pickens, and Spartanburg counties. Its foster care services have become increasingly in demand as an opioid epidemic has torn through a generation of young parents in the South. And elsewhere, by the way, the request has been made to the Department of Health and Human Services. That agency has been quietly taken over by hardline evangelical activists, a reward in appointments for their unwavering support of Trump's presidential bid and his administration. Beth Lesser is a Jewish parent turned away by Miracle Hill. Understand, in the upstate of South Carolina, if you want to be a foster parent or a mentor, there's DSS, which is the government, and there's Miracle Hill. There isn't really anybody else, she said. When Lesser still lived in Greenville, Beth Lesser participated in a three-day training co-hosted by Miracle Hill and Fostering Great Ideas, another regional child welfare agency. On the third day, two officials running the training told the group that non-Protestants wouldn't be able to mentor with Miracle Hill, let alone foster a child. "I've never felt that sort of discrimination before," said Ms. Lesser. Once they get the children in one of their group homes, they don't let non-Protestants mentor them, foster them, or anything. For the state of South Carolina's DSS, the practice of discriminating against Jewish families was too much. Back in January 2018, the DSS sent a letter raising concerns the agency was violating federal and state non-discrimination laws, as well as DSS policy, by requiring applicants to meet strict Protestant religious standards. Namely, they had to be practicing Protestants, not in a same-sex relationship. So Miracle Hill and Fostering Great Ideas went to the South Carolina legislature and changed the laws to permit discrimination on the basis of religion at the state level. You know, at a time when there is an acute shortage of foster families available for needy children, this seems, how shall I put it, unchristian, anti-Catholic, and not just a wee bit anti-Semitic, too? One hopes the administration sees the problem and addresses it promptly. Mrs. Lesser is a Trump supporter. She says she believes that if he knew the facts of the situation, he would immediately stop such discriminatory practices because, as she says, he is not a religious fanatic. In Warsaw, Poland, Israel's ambassador to Poland held a symbolic recreation of the establishment of the Israeli embassy there, the first Israeli mission ever established abroad. In September 1948, the State of Israel opened the post at the Bristol Hotel. At the time of its inauguration, the Israeli flag was hanging on the hotel balcony. Last week, Israeli Ambassador Anna Azari greeted invited guests on that same balcony. "Before I came to Poland, I didn't know that it was here that the first embassy of Israel opened," Azari admitted. "This year is special for both countries. Poland celebrates 100 years of independence, and we in Israel are 70. The Israeli ambassador said both countries have done a lot together, and I hope we will do even more over the next 30 years. Polish President Andrzej Duda offered his congratulations. 2018 is an opportunity to recall that Poland was one of the first countries to recognize the State of Israel, Duda wrote. Many citizens of the State of Israel came from Poland, Polin in Hebrew, and the Polish language resounded in Israeli houses and public institutions. In fact, the very first prime minister of Israel, the Protean figure David Ben-Gurion, was born in Poland. Poland and Israel became embroiled in a conflict earlier this year, reported on Too Jewish, over the law making it illegal to blame the Polish nation for crimes committed during the Holocaust. Several months later, the Polish parliament made it a civil offense rather than a criminal one. And our News That the Apocalypse is Approaching Rapidly department reports that there has been an uptick in the expense for bar mitzvah party celebrations. Rapper Cardi B revealed she performed at a bar mitzvah party last weekend. New York Post claims her fee was likely in the ballpark of $500,000. Not to be outdone, or at least trying to compete, up-and-coming rapper Rich the Kid performed at another bar mitzvah party at exactly the same time. He feted financier Howard Lutnick's son Ryan at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for a fee of approximately $250,000. Guests included the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson. These two are not the first hip-hop stars to perform at lavish Jewish bar and bar mitzvah parties. Nicki Minaj appeared in an infamous photo at a bar mitzvah in 2015, and just last year the rapper Drake, who is Jewish, threw himself a bar mitzvah-themed birthday party. Weirder and weirder. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Albi Slomovitz has been a longtime chaplain in the Navy. He has attained the rank of full captain, which is, I guess, kind of like colonel in the Army, for those of you.
Yes, a full colonel, bird colonel, they call it.
Yeah. Full bird colonel. He's written a book, The Fighting Rabbis, Jewish Military Chaplains in American History, one of the best books about the Jewish chaplaincy. He's also written a book, America's Other Klan, the United States Supreme Court, which we started with earlier in the show, and is a professor, a teacher, author, and soon to be another podcaster. So welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Albi, tell me a little bit about why you decided to go into the military and what it's like to be a Jewish chaplain.
Well, it's very interesting. I guess I had a number of motivations. One was I wanted to serve my country. Another motivation, which I guess only a Jewish person would understand, which is sort of sad in a way, was that I was always concerned that people would say to me, are you a loyal American? Have you, again, served the country? And that they would ask me that, and I'd be able to respond positively. Another motivation was I wanted to do something different. Many rabbis know that they can go into congregations, and hopefully congregations will always be there for them. But in this case, I met a rabbi who was in the reserves, Barry Green, Alav HaShalom, and he talked me into it. And as I say to people, 3 years became 20 years. And it was a wonderful career, and I was truly blessed.
So I want to talk about some of the chaplain heroes. Many of us, well, not many, but some of us know the story of the four chaplains, Rabbi Alexander Good among them. Tell that story, because I think it's incredible, and I'm not sure how many of our listeners have heard it.
Okay. And let me, if I could just step back for 1 second.
Because sure, of course.
There's something that people don't understand, and this story is a great example of that. One of the things that people don't understand is that when we go into the military, we're deliberately called, intentionally called chaplains, not rabbis. I mean, we're rabbis, priest ministers, but we're called chaplains. So in that instance, it wasn't unusual for me, wherever I served, to spend a good part of the day helping people who are not Jewish. I mean, sometimes people who haven't had military experience think that we only, like every chaplain only cares for their specific faith or denomination. And the reality is far from that. And so here, let's segue into, there was a ship called the Dorchester. It had been a sort of a supply ship before the war. World War II rolls around, and it's transformed into an army transport ship. It's in my book in the page 84, 85. And so here you have four chaplains, one rabbi, and three ministers who are going to go on the ship with 900 men who are going to serve in Europe. And it's January, and unfortunately, at this time, and this is part of World War II history, the Germans were using their submarines quite effectively and sinking a large number of our ships, so many of our ships never made it across the Atlantic to Europe. And so the captain of the ship, was called the Dorchester, was aware that they were in an area where submarines were active, and he basically says, we're going to start zigzagging through the water, but I want everyone to go to sleep with their full uniform on and their life jackets, just in case we're hit. Well, I explain to people when I'm talking live to them that often people don't know when you say go to sleep, you don't have a bed and a mattress. You have something called a rack in Navy terms, which is just a piece of steel bolted to the wall, which you drop down, and then you lay on that. And if everyone would just imagine going to sleep with your regular clothes on, and then that's your shoes and socks and maybe a jacket or maybe a raincoat. Well, these soldiers were down in the bows of the ship, and they, over the night, started taking off their life jacket. Somebody took off their shoes, on and on and on. It was stuffy down there. Unfortunately, around 1 a.m. in the morning, and this is early February 1943, the ship is hit. And it's hit with a torpedo, unfortunately, in such a place that they're told to abandon ship. Now, again, unfortunately, this isn't a cruise ship. This was a ship that had maybe enough lifeboats for 200 of the 900. Mm-hmm. So again, it's unimaginable the chaos that they were jolted out of their sleep, out of their slumber, and the lights are flashing, and they literally have about 20, 30 seconds to go from the lower decks of the ship, climb up ladders, get on the deck of the ship, the top deck, and jump into the lifeboats. Now, the chaplains had been an upper level, so they were sort of more prepared to handle what they were supposed to, and their job was to help the soldiers get on these lifeboats. Now, understand, that everyone kind of knew that if the ship was sinking, not only did you have to get in the lifeboat, but you had to row yourself away, because if the ship sank, it created sort of a vortex effect and would drag people down. It's February 3rd. They're off of the coast of Greenland. The water is bitterly cold. People will die of hypothermia. So within 30 seconds, the men are scampering up to the deck to jump on the lifeboats, and there's not enough for everybody. And as they come up, the different chaplains, again, one rabbi, one priest, two Protestants, are asking them, what happened to your life jacket? What happened to your boots? What happened to your gloves, etc.? And as the men come up, they say, well, I left it downstairs. I forgot. I took it off, whatever. And so these four chaplains, Fox, Poling, Washington, and Good, as the story went, give their own equipment to these men as they're coming up. So one of the chaplains takes off a life vest. Another one takes off his glove. Another one takes off their boots. And they give everything away. So what they end up doing is hurrying the men on the lifeboats, launching those lifeboats. And as the story goes, they stayed behind. They stayed with the ship. They linked arms. And everyone sort of said the final prayer, and they went down with the ship.
Tell me, when somebody decides to be a chaplain like you did, and I assume that there's a real shortage or a need for Jewish chaplains. Is that accurate?
Yep. Yep. There always was. You know, it's interesting. We sort of have a weird view as Jews in America that even when I was in from 79 to 99, so I've been out about almost 20 years now, but even when I was going in, we were very proud of our Israeli heroes and military fighters and the prowess of the Israeli Defense Force, appropriately so. But for some reason, there's sort of a latent in-house prejudice, I guess you would say, that for some strange reason, Jews don't belong in the military or the police or the FBI, whatever. And the truth is that that's not the case. I mean, I found that we were well represented in all branches of service, in the police, in the fire, and FBI, et cetera. So I don't know where that myth came from so much, but I do want to dispel it and let you know there are Jews in the military, some of whom you might say, well, doctors, dentists, yes. But also I had one tour at Great Lakes Naval Base where we take in our raw recruits and send them through the basic training and one time they sent me down to the Chicago airport to meet these young men and women, literally as they got off the plane, put them in a bus, take them up to Great Lakes, which is a little bit north of Chicago. And I had the opportunity just to talk with them. These were Jews and non-Jews. And I said, why are you here? And some of them said about, well, the educational opportunities, they get scholarships and all that later on if they serve. But most were just candid. They said, my father had served, and it's my time to serve the country as well, to give something back. So do know that in my book, going all the way back to the Civil War, even the Revolutionary War, Jews have always been part and parcel defending this country proudly. And so, of course, it's helpful to have rabbis, too, to go in and the whole gamut from Reform to Orthodox. So, yeah, there's a need of rabbis, but also, interestingly, people called lay leaders. You would put a rabbi in a particular geographic area and say, cover this part of the world. And so generally we couldn't cover all those places, but we had representatives. So you might have a Jewish doctor, Jewish dentist who would step forward and say, I will represent the Jewish community, or an enlisted person. And those folks were crucial in being in contact with the rabbi, so that when there was a holiday, Hanukkah, Passover, whatever, they would act in concert with the closest Jewish chaplain and make sure that the troops had coverage for their religious needs.
So I have to tell you, in the interest of full disclosure, that one of my ancestors, a rabbi, Aaron Del Banco, was one of the first Jewish chaplains in, I think, 1864, when Lincoln approved Northern chaplains didn't have to be Christian. And he actually went down to Vicksburg, conducted high holiday services for the Jewish soldiers there, who I assume are mostly German Jewish immigrants. And then on the way back, the steamship he was on blew up, whether it was a Confederate torpedo or sometimes they just blew up in those days, and he died. And he had two brothers in the Union Army who also were missing in action, who were never recovered. So I know a little bit about the early parts of the chaplaincy.
Well, I just mentioned quickly, in World War One, we were overrepresented. This is a great historical note that I highlight in the book, and when I speak publicly about this, is that imagine Jewish history after the German Jews come over. Of course, we have a larger wave of Russian Jews from the late 1800s to the early 1900s. This is my American history side speaking. And they're coming in large numbers. So now you have children. You have immigrant children, and World War One comes about, and they volunteer. And there are posters in Yiddish urging young men to serve the country. So imagine that the parents had come on this long journey across Europe, across the Atlantic, finally make it to America, see the Statue of Liberty, get settled, and their sons, a few daughters, but mostly sons, love America so much that they enlist, they go back on the ship, back to Europe, and in the trenches of France, and they're asking their rabbis to teach them English so they can speak better without an accent. They're asking to learn about how democracy works in America. I mean, it's just wonderful to realize that the children of many first-generation new Americans had such an affinity for the country that they're willing to risk their lives and go back to Europe and stand up for the country.
I feel like we could go on a good deal longer, but we're out of time. I want to thank Rabbi Albie Slomovitz for a great visit. We'll have to get you back here on Too Jewish.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
The book that we discussed mostly is called The Fighting Rabbis, Jewish Military Chaplains in American History, available on Kindle and on paperback and from Amazon and wherever books are sold, which is primarily these days Amazon. Where else can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, you know what? I would say just Google my name, Slomovitz, but I'm most proud of it. I'm starting a nonprofit, which I call Jewish Christian Discovery Center, and that's to help Christians. It's an educational nonprofit to help Christians understand their Jewish roots. The ultimate goal is to reduce anti-Semitism and to show Christians the whole midrashic process of giving new interpretations to the Bible. We have 2,000 years of not-so-great history we really have to address and make better.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Albie.
You're welcome.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the Soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Avital Chazanov, Regional Director of the Masa Israel Journey. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning is a cover of Arik Einstein's classic song, Shek Shenavo, by Shlomi Shabbat, Idan Imadi, Yuval Dayan, and Gea Vile. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace. האם יפרח לי עוד שושן? האם נאור בי ניצוץ נושן? האם בסוף הדרך מחכה תשובה לי? ואיך נדע אם יש תקווה שכשנבוא, שכשנבוא נמצא תשובה? ואיך נדע אם יש
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.